Welcome to the Nordic Mythology Podcast. I'm Daniel Farrand, owner of the company Horns of Odin. Today, I'm joined by a very special guest, Krista Vasshus. Is it okay?
That's very good.
Good, good. Krista, can you just tell people a little bit about who you are, what you specialize in, and maybe what we're going to cover?
Yeah. Well, you got my name, Krista Vasshus. I am a Norwegian interdisciplinary scholar. I've been educated as a linguist or the Nordic studies, so Scandinavian studies in languages. I've had a focus on place names and personal names, and the whole long linguistic history of the Scandinavian languages. Which has led me to take an interest in the deep history of the languages and prehistory of languages, the development of, you know, not just Norwegian or Scandinavian, but, you know, proto language stages like Proto-Germanic, even Indo-European. So compared to my colleagues who all, at least from the university that I have been working at the most, university in Bergen, they consider me a bit old-fashioned because I deal with this old things, runes and stuff like this. Mm-hmm. Very, very ancient. But you know, having had that interest, it's led me onto the path of runology, which is deeply fascinating. And we've been so lucky that we've had a couple of really interesting runic finds, and I've been invited as, you know, the linguists who will try and reconstruct or figure out what these small pieces of language that we have chiseled into stone and gold, what does it mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when you got into linguistics, is that, I'm trying to figure out, how does that work? Do you just study, is it just a study of languages as an overall thing? Because obviously, how do you get into doing things that you do now where it's specializing in languages from 1500 years ago?
Yeah. My way into it was considering being a Norwegian teacher.
Okay.
That's what most people I've shared the education with ended up as, either as scholars or Norwegian teachers.
Is it, when you say a Norwegian teacher, as in?
That would be, teaching school kids. So primary school and high school.
Yeah. That's so funny, because being an English person, we call our English classes English class, because I teach in English, and I just did not make the connection when you said Norwegian teacher to being. Yeah. I thought it was I thought it was you teaching English to Norwegian kids. Don't know why I thought that, but I guess that would be English class.
That would be. You could also get into linguistics in that way. I think one of my friends almost did that. So starting off with English studies and went on with Old English. So
I did not make that connection. So okay, so it would be teaching Norwegian
in primary schools and high schools and things like this. But I figured that I really quite enjoyed writing my master's thesis. I wrote my master's thesis on pre-Christian groves, place names containing certain elements telling about the pre-Christian groves. So using toponymy to really sort of reconstruct the cultic activity in Norway.
Mm-hmm. So you clearly had an interest in that pre-Christian world time period before you went
I had the interest of religion for years and years before I started studying, but it didn't all fall in place until I took this one course in place names, where I had to figure out a topic for a dissertation. And with my background, my supervisor recommended that I would, you know, take the religious aspect of it, because mm-hmm. made sense out from my interests and the topics that I had been studying earlier. I also have like the foundation of what's it called, the scientific study of religion. So 1 year all in all of studying scientific mm-hmm. study of religion. So I had that plus this interest in history and so on. So that's made sense. And I went on and wrote something about pre-Christian cults on the basis of place names.
Mm-hmm.
And went on from there. The reason I started off with place names in the first place was it was the only subject on our university that would slightly touch upon the language stage that would be earlier than Old Norse.
Okay.
You could see that there's a lot of his interests that came in and sort of came together into something more interesting in this place name.
Okay, I have a question that I have to ask, because I used to do this show with Dr. Matthias Nordvig for many years. And he always had a problem with the term Old Norse. So I feel like I wouldn't be doing him justice if I didn't ask the question. He would always tell me how I should use common Nordic, I think was the term he preferred. And because obviously most people always refer to Old Norse and use that as kind of the umbrella term for the language that was used in the Viking Age.
Yeah.
How accurate is that?
It's a construction, so to speak. It's sort of like saying Norwegian today. Norwegian is a lot of things. I mentioned before we started that my parents pronounce my name differently because they have different dialects. Would be the same in the Viking Age. And so when I say Old Norse, I typically mean the West Norse. If I meant Old Danish, I would generally say Old Danish. If I meant Old Swedish, I would say that. But of course, Old Scandinavian is just as good as a term, I think. Old Common Scandinavian, was it? He called it?
Common Nordic, maybe?
Yeah.
I think it was Common Nordic, maybe he used.
Yeah, sure. That's okay. Of course. Old West Norse and Old East Norse split up at some point during the time period that we call or generally consider to be Old Norse.
Mm-hmm.
But it's
semantics. It's
very interesting and very detailed.
Because I probably delve in some circles that I shouldn't at times, being like Facebook groups that have all sorts of interesting, colorful people in them. And it does seem like this term Old Norse is used for anything and everything that's a language from the Viking Age, I guess.
It's inaccurate to just say everything from Scandinavia in the Viking Age is Old Norse. Old Norse is the language. Well, in the books, when I write about it, it's the language stage between approximately 700 something, maybe 800, up unto 1515, maybe.
Okay.
That's when Old Norse has utterly collapsed. And of course, there's a transition period before, maybe from the Black Death, around the start of the Black Death up until the mid of the 15th or mid of the 16th century. There's a transition period. And after that, you would have the modern Scandinavian languages. So modern Swedish, modern Danish, modern Norwegian.
Okay, I'm getting off topic, but
yeah,
what's the reason that a language just would just die like that and a new modern version? Do we know why that happens?
There are so many factors that come into play. And some of the factors in the transition from Old Norse to Norwegian is, well, it has to do with the Black Death, of course. Loads of people died. In Norway, I think, at least when I went to school, we considered about 2/3 of the population to have perished during Black Death. And we have to also remember that the Black Death wasn't just one incident. It was several waves of plague that hit. And over how many years was that? Maybe that's not too important in this case. But the point is that when a lot of the population dies, there are so many things in the society that will be affected by it. I mean, even the nobility that we had in Norway collapsed. Even the royal houses sort of, you know, it was the aftermath of the Black Death that really made the union between Norway and Denmark so tight, because the royal houses became one. That's one factor, but the main factor is, of course, the populace. Loads of land was available to the survivors. They would go out, pick the best land. The poor people would suddenly have plenty of space and, you know, finances, because land is money in this period of time. And so they were able to produce loads of kids. And so in this period, we might have had a period with a high level of youth. And, you know, kids nowadays, they're not different from kids then. They twist language and they do terrible things to it. And
so, are you going to tell me that Norwegian is just slang?
Norwegian is slang in a sense. Yeah, of course, there are plenty of other factors that come into play here, and many of the developments we can see, they start off before the Black Death. So it's not all because all of a sudden people didn't bother to pronounce things correctly. There are inner forces in the language that, you know, makes certain developments easier. All the Scandinavian languages developed fairly similarly, whereas Icelandic and Faroes didn't develop in the same way. Of course, some of that has to do with the contact between, you know, mainland Scandinavia contra being on islands. But yeah, I think we're diverging a bit.
A little bit. So what on earth happened to Finland? Why is that so different?
Finland has, of course, a population that spoke Swedish and has had that since the Viking Age. A small population in the west and south coast. And most of the population are speakers of other languages. Finnish is, of course, the majority language, and then you have Sami languages as well. Mm-hmm. And they belong to a different language family altogether. So they're not, well, of course, some people would say they are related to Indo-European languages, but they are not, in any case, very closely related to the Germanic languages. Let's just say it like that.
Okay. Yeah. So is there a reason that that doesn't, that never really mixed over? Like, I've always been curious as to why there is that kind of line or divide that of where one language family is and the other one. Hmm. And then we'll get back on topic, I promise. But this one has always interested me.
When it comes to the spread of Finnic languages into Scandinavia and Germanic languages the other way, of course, there is somewhat of an overlap. Sami languages are spoken in the same area as Swedish and Norwegian and Finnish. So there are overlaps, and Sami languages have had a huger spread much further south into Scandinavia than they are today. Okay. Historically, it's simply a matter of people having or have had migrated at some periods of time.
Fair enough. All right, let's get back to, I guess, runes is where I was going to start with. Just on a little bit before, if you're trying to translate something, as so many armchair runologists do from their little chart that they get off Google, or the other way around, when they want to translate their, not their name, but maybe a phrase into Old Norse. You always see people say, oh, well, you have to translate it to Icelandic and then the runes. That's the one that you usually see of how to get it most accurate. But when you find something like the Bractid and you have to go about, and as you touched on before, how there are the different variations of the East Nordic or Danish, do you have to... How do you go about analyzing? First of all, you have to take the runes and then figure out what language they're in before you can kind of figure out then what they say. It feels like it's a little bit of a back and forth. Like, you're looking at something, you have to then figure out what it is, but then go back to it to then try and work out what it says.
When it comes to bractates, it's very easy because all the bractates are made in, or were made in, a very short period of time.
Okay.
The exact dates are somewhat disputed, but possibly the end of the 300s. Usually they're dated to about, 400s up until the mid 500s or the last part of the 500s. So it's about 150 to 200 years of fashion, let's say.
Okay.
And in this period of time, Old Norse was not a thing. The language is not Old Norse. It's the language stage before Old Norse, which means that all the runic inscriptions from Scandinavia at this time are pretty much identical in their language form. You can really see the difference between Danish, Swedish, and Norwegian at this time. That happens much, much later.
Okay.
And they're written in the Elder Futhark.
Mm-hmm.
So the earliest runic form, which develops through time as soon as you get into the Viking Age, you have a new system of younger Futhark.
Mm-hmm.
Things look different. The spelling is different. And the sounds are different. Because they're different languages. It's like, a Viking would not have understood the language spoken in the 500s. So the language on the Bractates would be incomprehensible to someone in the Viking Age. do you follow?
I know, I do. Yeah, absolutely. It's just, I love these conversations where it just gets my little brain going, and it's going all, because again, I've said this so many times on the podcast, how you've, because when something is so long ago, it's so easy to just negate a couple of hundred years. It's like, it's just a couple of hundred years.
Yeah.
But a lot happens in that time. And
you can.
In this case, like you said, the whole language shift. And but then I think, you know, would I really, I've tried reading Shakespeare at school. So I don't understand some of that. So it makes pure sense that things would have changed. And but you just, again, you kind of just forget that these shifts happen when you're just kind of skimming over it.
Yeah. So we touched upon the Black Death earlier, that in the mid 1300s, the Black Death arrived in Scandinavia, and it took 200 years approximately before we had the, at least for the part of, for in Norway, it took about 200 years before we changed from the Old Norse language to the modern Norwegian dialects.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty much almost exactly the same thing that happened in the Iron Age. 541, the Justinian Plague hit at least Europe, and we should expect the rest of Northern Europe as well.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been a plague. Of course, this happened just a couple of years after a catastrophic incident, a cosmic incident, possibly a volcano, possibly a meteor, that blocked sunlight. And we can see this in the archaeological material, the dendrochronology, where you look at the size of the rings in trees from mm-hmm. the archaeological material. We can say that year 537, 539, and 540 and 41 has been cold throughout the summer. Now, winter during the summer. Led many scholars to believe that the myth about the Fimbul winter
mm-hmm.
Preceding the Ragnarok is actually real events that happened in the 500s.
So somewhere Matthias's ears are picking up, because he loves volcanoes. This is right up his alley. Is there a reason when you say like odd, when you're saying the different years, is there a reason like it skips a year, or is it just that you can't?
I couldn't say. That's something that the archaeologists would have to but the point here is that we have this catastrophe, we have the absence of sunlight, which surely must have meant absence of cereal grains and crops and so on, in combination with the plague. And then we can see in the runic material that the language changes quite dramatically. The runes themselves also change quite dramatically. It's reshaped into a new system. Many of the runes stay more or less the same, or at least similar. But the system will be different. And the language on the other side of those 200 years is different. So therefore, we operate with the term. Yeah. So if Old Norse is a problematic term, the name of this, the Iron Age language in Scandinavia, that's a can of worms.
Okay, often, go on.
Often we have called it Proto-Norse.
Okay.
Which is problematic because a proto language, the use of the word proto implies that it's a reconstructed language, that we haven't got any sources, written sources, but, which is not the case for this language. In Scandinavian, we call it Ur-Nordisk. It's also the word for it in German, Ur-Nordisch, which means primordial Nordic, early Nordic, ancient Nordic. Yeah, so it's a difficult child to name. lately I've just started calling it by its Norwegian term, Ur-Nordisk, even when I write English, because I'm so tired of having to have all the disclaimers when
I guess you have to put the little asterisks and just
something like that.
Must be frustrating. Okay, you did answer one of the questions I've always wondered, and that was why the runes made that shift from Elder Fudak to because it did seem anybody, particularly entry level, who gets interested in this stuff, the first thing they go to is runes. It's one of the most fascinating and probably misunderstood, misinformed areas of this whole time period.
Yeah. It's always something that makes my head shake quite a lot whenever I see the Elder Futhark used to spell an Old Norse word, an example. It's just silly. but of course, that's me being a complete nerd about runes.
I don't think it's silly. I think it's such a tough one, and I don't even know, like you say, if we're talking kind of worms, this is definitely one of them, because I think everybody who gets into this, and so many people just want to translate their dog's name into runes. And if not, they want to, I think, like, that's the most common one, is they want to do a phrase that means something to them, so then they try to put it into Icelandic, because Icelandic's apparently closest to Old Norse, and then go from there and do it that way. And I never knew, up until 2 minutes ago, the reason why, like, Elder Futhark swapped from that to younger, and the whole reason behind, well, the whole thing of, like, them being two separate languages.
Yeah.
Like, I just assumed it was the same language all the way through, but for some reason they were just like, nah, sub these other runes. We're just going to get rid of them, and let's just go down to 16 and change the sounds. I didn't realize that there was literally a change in language.
There was a change in language, and for some odd reason, the Futhark was not expanded in Scandinavia. If we look at the Anglo-Frisian runes used in Frisia and England, the opposite happens.
Yeah.
Because the language in Scandinavia had umlauts, we have some new vowels in particular, that it would be obvious to expand the Futhark and just have more runes. But instead of that happening, there are fewer now. it's a bit of an odd thing. But if you look at the Anglo-Frisians, they expanded it and made a perfect system where the runes would correspond to the sounds they would have, which made Scandinavian Viking Age runic inscriptions, well, the orthography is a bit odd. So it's not, you couldn't write with, one to one, that each sound in the language did not correspond to one rune. So you would have to have some odd orthographies like we do today. I mean, English language is not spelled the same way as it's pronounced, and this neither is Danish or Norwegian, for that matter, although Danes often see Norwegian spelling as more authentic compared to how it's pronounced. But all the Germanic languages have orthography. We're not one to one, and the same goes for runic inscriptions, as far as we can tell, at least in the Viking Age. probably also in, well, also in the Iron Age. So the runic inscriptions from, yeah, whenever they show up in the records to about 600-700, where they try and definitely mash things a bit up in the 600s.
That must make it so much more difficult having to try and translate. Is translate the right word, or is it?
We first have to transliterate and then interpret and translate. Yeah, so that's a bit of a process.
it's part of it. especially with the younger, it seems like it would be more difficult if you have a rune that can have more than one sound.
It can be. If you have short inscriptions, they can be quite difficult to interpret. That goes for any short inscription. I mean, if you have a graffiti with one word written on a train, what does it mean? When it comes to the Viking Age languages, we have a much larger corpus because Old Norse, Old Danish, Old Swedish, they're all written languages that, you know, have established traditions in the medieval period. So we have large corpuses on these languages, plenty of words, plenty of texts to compare with. But on the other hand, when we look at the Ur-Nordisk, the Iron Age language, the only language we have in the sources are the runic inscriptions. And of course, the reconstructed language that we, you know, use comparative, what's it called now? This is what I do for a living, and I can't recall the English terms for it.
It happens. It happens.
Comparative linguistics.
Okay. There we go. I do it all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not my job, and language is definitely not my strongest suit, but I do forget things.
We all do, and I forgive myself every day for all the spelling errors I make.
Do you get that? Do you ever have
all
people who just expect you to be perfect though? Like,
whenever I, you know, correct exams and so on, it's easy for me to see which are the mistakes that are systematic. Those are the ones that you would have to, you know, properly, you know, this is not good. Mm-hmm. But if there's a spelling mistake, everyone does it. It doesn't matter unless it's really important for some reason in a particular text. Of course, in everyday life, one spelling error is not important. And we see it in the runic corpus as well. There are spelling errors in the runic corpus, definitely. Mm-hmm. So we've done it for a couple of thousand years, and I'm sure we won't stop today.
No, absolutely not. Even with spell checker, I still spell words wrong.
Yeah.
I still managed to get it wrong somehow. So you mentioned the longer the inscription, the easier it is. Is that down to that you can
you have the context, and you the longer it is, you sort of see the names and the verbs, and all the components become clearer. Whereas if you have maybe two words, there can be a bigger room for possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, the Ur-Nordisk language is there are very often issues with interpreting it because there's more than one possibility. Many of the inscriptions from the Elder Futhark, they follow certain patterns. So typically, I name the person's name did this, wrote this, made this, something like that. That's a typical pattern you see. And if the inscription follows that, perfect. You it's easier to interpret it because you have the syntax is clear and it started with the ek or the pronoun. It's sort of easier to put all the pieces together. But as soon as you have a bit of a freer text, which aren't many, we have a few of those really long texts. And when I say really long, I mean 8 words or more. and they freestyle a bit. It's all of a sudden a bit more difficult. Yeah.
Okay. Are there any texts or words that you can be like 100% certain on, or do they all have to have almost that kind of asterisk to them where this is the absolute best we can do, but it still could maybe be something else? Or is there any that we can just go, no, this is what it says 100%?
Yeah. I think the golden horns of Galahus is a perfect example where it says, Ek flewagastis holtias hornata vido. There's no doubt about what it means. It means I, Lewagastir, and then, yeah, of course, there's certain possible of interpreting the following word as a patronym. So maybe it means son of Holt or someone who comes from Holt, but certainly ends with made the horn. So I, Lewagastir, from Holt or son of Holt, made the horn. The golden horn. It's quite clear, and we have a few of those inscriptions that everything is just absolutely clear.
Yeah, I don't know whether you'll know the answer to this or not. What do you think the reason is that they wrote it like that? They put like I made this. Is it maybe like a maker's mark so you can give the, I don't know, because especially with something like the gold horn, I assume they're not a personal piece. They will have been made for some sort of elite, somebody of a position of power. So to write your name on it, I guess that's kind of like putting as if to say they're of a high quality because this person made them and they give them.
Yeah. That's an excellent question. I don't think I have an answer that is, better than a lot of other answers. There's certainly, we have some inscriptions that mention people making the object, and then there are other inscriptions that says this person wrote the inscription.
Mm-hmm.
So on a piece of jewelry, it can say he or she wrote this. And in other inscription, he or she made this. And why do they feel the urge to say that they wrote and made this? Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting question.
It is. My thoughts was whether it almost added a value to it, because in the same way that we kind of do it today with brands, or anything, you could have two paintings identical, but one could say made by Banksy in the corner, and this one is infinitely more valuable than the other one.
We seem to have a smith, a weaponsmith, who stamped. Oh, and now I'm gonna have to choose my pronoun about this person. Is it a he or is it a she? Usually, people tend to say it's a him.
They would assume, yeah.
Yeah. And I'm not going into that discussion right now.
We can say we don't know
them,
if it's a he. Yes,
they put their name, stamped their name into, I think it's three cases of lances with stamps. So this smith is a known smith, and made several weapons that are, yeah, have been used during the Iron Age. It's pretty much a brand. If you want weapon of good quality, remember to go to Wagnio.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was wondering. Or with the combs that say, "I so and so made this." Is like, is that just a? Was he a good comb maker? So you wanted that comb because you're like, that's gonna.
That's excellent quality. Perfect for my curly beards. Mm-hmm.
Because it's true, you know, we find all these beautiful objects and it's obviously the only ones that survive, but there will have been some good and some shitty makers that we have that today. You know, we have some good craftspeople and some bad craftspeople. Bad craftspeople, you're going to be able to pick it up at a much more affordable price. The ones that last are going to be more expensive. And there's nothing to suggest that it wouldn't have been the same back there. You'd have had more affordable and more expensive.
Certainly, yeah.
So, yeah, isn't history fascinating?
All too fascinating. I could be doing this all day.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure you probably do.
Yes, to a large extent, I do, yes.
Okay, let's talk about the bracte that we're mainly here to talk about, which was hit the news for being the oldest runic inscription of Odin, am I right? Or is the oldest inscription of Odin?
The oldest inscription containing the name that later developed into the name Odin.
Oh, okay. That doesn't make as catchy a headline, does it?
Yeah, it's a bit of an uphill thing to sell on SoMe for the SoMe experts.
Yeah, the artist, not formally known as Odin, but. What would be the word? I'm not sure what the word would be for before. Free? Nah, I'm not sure. Yeah.
Yeah, but the bractate containing this inscription was, of course, written in the Ur-Nordisk. I'm going to stick with that term. The language stage before Old Norse.
Mm-hmm.
And in this language stage, the name of Odin would be Wodanas or Wodinas.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the name that we meet on the bracket. It says, Is Wodanas Werar, which means he is Odin's man.
Mm-hmm.
Or possibly, who is Odin's man? Where this who then would be a subordinary clause. Something, something, something. Who is Odin's man? I mean, mm-hmm. So the person who is Odin's man would be mentioned earlier in this inscription then. This bractate was a part of a gold hoard found in Denmark. Containing almost 800 grams of gold. With several bractates, six of them have runic inscriptions. So Lisbeth Imar and myself, we have been putting them under the microscope to try and figure out what it says. Because, you know, bractates, they're not very big.
Mm-hmm.
They were inspired by medallions that were used on necklaces probably in the Roman Empire.
Okay.
And they were probably used as, you know, yeah, something that would you would put in a necklace hanging in front of you.
Okay.
So
are we talking like an inch across, like 25 centimeters?
Oh, we...
2.5 centimeters, 25 millimeter. That kind of
something like that. Of course, there are different sizes. Some of them are bigger than others, but generally in this gold hoard, they are big compared to other finds. In fact, the biggest bracteate ever found was in this gold hoard.
Okay.
It did not contain runic inscriptions, this biggest one, but a couple of ones. They're enormous.
So would that be, again, do you think that would be like a status thing?
Absolutely.
I don't know if you've ever seen Flavor Flav, who wears the big clock around his neck. I don't suppose you're probably familiar with that. He's a rapper who wears like a massive clock. And I don't know why. Something about, I don't know, there must be a reason, but I feel like it's that kind of thing, just a big, ridiculous status symbol.
Yeah. I think the use of the word ridiculous is quite fitting, because if someone were to wear these medallions in a necklace, I think the likelihood of it looking a bit ridiculous is quite big. Because, they're so enormously huge. Of course, we don't know exactly in what situations they were used, because we don't have any written sources from this time. We have a source from Saxo Grammaticus, who was a Danish medieval scholar. Scholar, was he? Well, sort of. He wrote the Gesta Danorum, history of Denmark. And he has a passage where he speaks of these legendary kings, which, you know, belong to the Iron Age legendary period. So in principle, this means that it could be a story that has been, you know, gone on in oral tradition up until from the Iron Age 500s possibly up until Saxo Grammaticus wrote them down. A story about a king who, as payment for some job that he wants a woman to do, gives her a necklace. And the way he explains this necklace looks and how it, more or less how it looks, I don't see what else it could be than a bracteate. And he, Saxo, says straight out that this was not something you could use. It was purely a luxury for adornment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I guess it would be for when there was a big party or a celebration.
Possibly, yes.
You see, people don't change. And yeah. I truly believe that we all do it.
It's the red carpet of the Iron Age. You would pull out your bracteates and what else they might have had.
Yeah, and it might not be the most comfortable of things, but I'm sure there are many, many people out there who have donned those red-soled Louis Vuittons, and they're the most uncomfortable things that they've worn in forever, and their feet are sore. But just for that moment where they can keep them on, it's that status symbol of, look what I have.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it was no different back then either. You know, these things were just kind of a symbol of, look at me, look what I can afford.
Yeah. I think that's quite right. The status symbol of the gold in itself is amazing, and the everything that is on the bracteates is absolutely fascinating. It's a world that has fascinated me for a long time, and I cannot believe my luck that I am able to actually work with them now, because, you know, the look and the runes and everything that goes on in these bracteates is deeply fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, the imagery in the bracteates are also to a large extent inspired by Roman iconography.
Okay.
Clearly, it starts off as a sort of copying the imagery of the emperors. Some of the bracteates look like an emperor presenting a Victoria statue, but other bracteates are very clearly extremely Nordic. In the animal style, where the hair turns into a bird and the nostrils becomes wings and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
So it starts off with clearly imitating something Roman and then ends up with being complete Nordic mishmash of animals and
acid style. Trip.
Yeah, acid trip is
that's what I feel it would be accurate.
Yeah.
So do you find, am I right in thinking that they found Roman medallions with them?
Yes, they did. Some medallions that are clearly Roman, and then some medallions that try to imitate something Roman, and then something entirely Germanic with runes and everything.
Mm-hmm. So would that be do you think that's a case of just these beautiful things from a faraway land? So you just imitate it because everybody would want one, and it's the cool thing.
I think you're asking an excellent question here, because we have plenty of indications that the Germanic people did not just write straight out adopt anything Roman. The Romans had plenty of lovely stuff, plenty of interesting clothings and anything you could dream of. If you could afford it, you could get it there, but they don't seem to just adopt it straight out. They seem to have a particular need to remake it into something different in order to use it. But it doesn't. It's not always 100% true. Some things, like wine, we find wine bottles. I'm not sure they actually find wine bottles, but certainly Roman equipment, weapons, the gold, of course, is Roman. Runic writing is, of course, definitely inspired by the Roman majuscule, so the Latin script. Probably also other alphabets, but certainly the people of the Germanic people of the north and in mid Europe, they have been in contact with the Romans for a long time, and they can see all this juicy and lovely stuff that the Romans have, and they sort of want it, but they certainly don't want to be Roman.
So
they try and do something about it that makes it Germanic instead of Roman. Right. And so you have runes and then...
Inspired by.
Yes.
That's what it is.
Yes. But this is, as I said, not always 100% accurate. And I'm not sure whether it was something they did deliberately, or it's just what happened to show up in the archaeological records. It's difficult to say, but my impression is certainly that they had felt the need to not just be Roman or adapt something Roman, but had the need to stay somewhat different.
Yeah. There's just one thing that comes to mind, and this might be offensive or not, but I'm going to go with it. So we'll just see what happens. I can't help but thinking of when you were describing it like that, the Scandinavia is kind of like, or could be, the Chinese factories today that take the, I don't know, Michael Kors handbag and just change it just enough that they can then resell it and pretend that it's not the Michael Scott handbag, but then put it back out into the world and be like, we've not copied it. It's just similar-ish, just so the rumors don't come and sue them.
In some way, I think that the comparison is fair, yeah. In some
it's
way.
There. Maybe, yeah, maybe. I don't know. I think that's kind of what I was, the image I was getting in my mind of like, we're going to take this and we're going to change it just enough that it passes, passes the test so we don't get sued.
Yeah. It's not 100% inaccurate, I think.
Yeah. Wonderful. So the actual imagery.
Yeah.
How important is that?
It has been enormously important in the history of studying the bractites. I mean, the whole it's a long history where people have been wishing to see certain things, Odin most of all, in the imagery. I mean, the consensus has been that every portrayed person on the bractites more or less is Odin or possibly some other deity.
In I feel like that's
something
that's
of an Odin cult. I have never adhered. I'm not sure how to pronounce that. So I've never been a fan of this theory.
Okay, yeah.
I don't really see it. Certainly, there are scenes that definitely will have been perceived as belonging to mythology. I mean, there's a good example of a bractite where a man holds his hand inside the mouth of a wolf.
Oh,
and
okay.
It's impossible to see that and not think of
Fenrir
and the Tyr myth. I mean,
okay.
It's
absolutely, of course.
But all the others that don't clearly have some sort of obvious connection to a myth, they're just, I mean, they're portrayals of something that looks like a leader of society. I mean, it's more or less a copy of the Roman Emperor, just in a Germanic way. So it's more likely a king or a ruler or something like that. But as I said, we also have imagery that are clearly religious, at least when we know the myths that were written down in the medieval years, which is 700 years after the bractites were made.
Mm-hmm. I've never really thought of it like this. And I guess you don't, maybe I'm completely wrong about this. I don't know if this is the case, but I feel like you don't really see Christians putting Jesus on a coin. And maybe I'm completely wrong, but I feel like it is more when you have coins and it tends to be the ruler of that land would have their face on a coin or on a medallion or something valuable. It doesn't seem like the done thing is to, but I guess you have like crosses which would symbolize.
Yeah, absolutely.
But when it comes to like a side profile, it very much feels, but maybe that's because of the coins I look at today that still have Queen Elizabeth on.
I think a lot of it may have to do with tradition and not just being universally impossible to put a god on a coin or a medallion.
But I guess even with the Roman ones, they would be the living emperor.
Yes, but the thing is, of course, that the emperor is a god. So he is one of his main issues with Jesus was that Jesus did not want to acknowledge him as a god. So he got really mad about that.
Okay. But I guess at least he's a living person rather than
the living person, and he's got divine right. He is a part of the pantheon and so on, and I think this is also important in in the adaptation of this particular object in the Germanic world is because we, the Germanic tribes, had sacral kingship.
Mm-hmm.
The kings were, well, if not just divine right, then certainly, well, some of the kings we know of have the origin myths as descending from gods.
Yeah. Of course, because it gives you a much more stake to the claim of
divine legitimacy.
Yeah, absolutely. But do we see anything when it comes to the Roman ones, I guess, of with someone like Jupiter on, or like the actual deities rather than a figure who, because that's kind of, I guess, where you would, I assume, where you would look for maybe the comparisons of whether they would put Odin or Thor or like a, I feel me, I don't know, like a mythological type.
Yeah, that could well be a good way of comparing it. I haven't done that, but that's certainly something that should be done. But when we have been looking at these bractates, well, for the only reason I'm in on this project has been because I'm the historical linguist.
Yeah, of course.
I have knowledge about the language of the Scandinavian Iron Age.
Mm-hmm.
So my job has exclusively been interpreting what the words here say and what they might mean, and mm-hmm. comparing it to other words in Germanic languages and even in Indo-European in general.
Mm-hmm. If we're just taking the word for Odin, when we see just that word, I remember seeing at the time this came out, quite a few people commenting saying how it doesn't necessarily mean Odin, the mm-hmm. god. It could be, was it common for that it would be used as like a name? So it could have been a king who shared the name Odin, and this was just something that was given whoever the wearer was. I guess it could be like signing an allegiance to, you wear it is because you are their man, that you assign your loyalty to them.
Let me try and find the right way of phrasing this. Okay, so if someone would be called Bear Grylls, an example. I assume you know of Bear Grylls.
Yes. Yeah,
yes. When you think of him, do you ever think that someone possibly could view his name as meaning bear, as in the animal? Is there any possibility of making that connection in any situation, in a meme on the internet or somehow?
No, you know who Bear Grylls is.
Yeah. Well, my point is, when someone has a name, say your name would be Odin,
mm-hmm.
It's, you cannot avoid that being the same as the god. So even if it's a name for someone else, it's somehow simultaneously also the name of the god. It's impossible not to be.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I guess you get am I right in thinking in Latin countries, like Jesus is a very
exactly
popular name.
Yeah.
Which would be spelled the same as Jesus. Am I right?
Yeah. It's named after Jesus. So Jesus is pretty much the Spanish version of Jesus.
Yeah.
And it's a given name, and the reason why it's a given name is, of course, because it's the name of a certain prophet. Yeah. That has been very, very important in,
And obviously Muhammad is a very popular name.
Exactly. And there is, you can't be named Muhammad without having somehow a connection to the prophet. Same with Jesus. It's also a connection to Jesus Christ. And if someone hypothetically were named Odin in the Viking Age or Wodanas in the Iron Age, it's impossible that they would not have somehow been seen as a connection to the deity. It means both things simultaneously.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But when it comes to this particular bractate, it makes no sense thinking that you would say he is this other dude's man.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That got me thinking. I feel like in about 13 years, we're going to have a bunch of Odins turning up. Because I feel like that's just about the time that the Vikings TV show came out and the popularity happened. I feel like we're going to have a whole generation.
In Scandinavia, we have a lot of them already.
Is it still quite a popular name?
It has been for some time.
Okay.
We have had a couple of periods of Nordic Renaissance when it comes to personal names. So when the first sagas were translated into modern language form, it got a hit, and plenty of people with names that you wouldn't have had for centuries, or with names that had developed further into the Scandinavian forms. Like in Norway, we had the name Ole, but suddenly a lot of people were named Olaf, which is the Old Norse form of the name Ole.
Okay.
So we have a lot of that. And many of the gods, I mean, people are called Loki and Thrymr and so on. So they're named after Jotnar and deities that if you went to someone in the Viking Age who would, you know, adhere to the religion of that time, they would think it's a bit odd to have these names of humans, I would assume.
Oh, yeah. That just made me think. When I had Colin Dale on, this was many, many moons ago, quite a few episodes ago. He's in Denmark, and his son, I believe, is called Loki. And if I remember rightly, he had to apply. This is a very foreign idea to me, that he had to apply to like the Danish government to be able to call his son Loki.
Really?
And prove that it is a historical name, that he could find it in like a document. I'm definitely not remembering this wrong.
No, because but I completely recognize this. I also got my children in Denmark and had to prove that my Norwegian spelling of these names are relevant, and somehow I can draw a history to them. Why should they have this kind of name? Well, I'm Norwegian, so I have this. I had to find documents and so on to prove this to be proper naming of a child in Denmark.
Yeah,
But it surprised me that Loki was not. I know plenty of Danes named Loki. Maybe it's because he had an ending with the E.
Maybe it was a different spelling. Yeah. But I'm pretty sure that's what it was. And that whole idea, like I say, is so foreign, because in England, you could just call your kid Sofa if you wanted.
We have some restrictions in Scandinavia. Which is good, but sometimes we have a bit of a hassle with it.
I remember when he first told me about it, and I was just like, what? You can't just call your kid anything? Which I actually agree with, because I feel like some children have outlandish names now. I feel like it's almost become fashionable to try and give children the most absurd name you can, because you just want to be different and be like, oh, look at what my kid's called. And I think in the long run, it could have like a negative effect on the kid when it's at school, but that's going down a whole different rabbit hole. So I quite like the idea that this exists, but I just didn't know that it was even a real thing.
Yeah, it is. It is a real thing.
Wonderful. Okay, so on the back to the Brecht here, the little man, the little face on there, would we be right in assuming that that would be Odin, if this is talking about, or when he says he is Odin's man, do they mean the little man on the figure is Odin's man, or does it mean that this is Odin on it and whoever's wearing it is Odin's man?
Excellent question. We ask the same question. So we don't know whether this person is Odin's man or whether it's no connection between imagery and text, because we know that some images are copied elsewhere with different texts or no texts at all. So a bractate can be, generally we have, they're stamped. So they're made with a stamp on a tin, in a thin gold foil.
Okay.
So the, you sort of have the negative of the stamp.
Yeah.
So this is also the reason why we read it counterclockwise. It's the opposite way of, you know, you have to read it from right to left, and it goes in a perpetual circle. So there's no knowing of where it starts and ends.
Okay. I thought that they would be stamped with a positive, but just from behind.
Yeah. It would make sense, but nope.
Yeah, that's... wonder why that is. And I guess that's similar to how English coins are. I'm trying to think if I've got one in my pocket. But we have a text the whole way around, I think. I'm trying to pull one out of my pocket. Yeah, so we have dots in there to say where...
Separation marks.
Yeah, but we have a text the whole way around. Obviously, we have like Queen Elizabeth and then all these little letters that nobody knows what it means, but it's just to say how good the Queen is.
Yeah.
Or King now. I always forget that that's a thing now as well.
Yes, you have. You changed all your coins?
No, not yet. I haven't seen a King one. I feel like I should keep it, and maybe in 30 years it might be worth something. We can get one of the early ones.
It's possible. But in this Brecht, there are no separation marks, just a long row of runes.
Oh, yeah.
And we figured out that it seems to be 8 words. And it definitely ends with "is Vodana Sverar," meaning he is or who is Odin's man. Mm-hmm. But some of the runes in the sequence before this are very worn, possibly because the stamp was a bit weaker on one side, or possibly just because of general wear and tear. It's possible that the person who has been wearing it has been touching it in one particular place, because it looks like it could be a right-handed person who would have been moving their finger over it for quite a lot of times, because it's so worn. So one of the runes is almost completely impossible to see at all. We can see that there's a rune supposed to be there, but we can't see which rune it is. And it's a very important rune.
Of course it is.
Because it would give us the grammar and the class of... So it's important.
Mm-hmm. So Do you think that that's... Do you think there's any significance to that rune being worn and its importance to...
It could be.
Or do you think it's just a coincidence of where it is?
It's impossible to say, really. But it could well be that it's a significant place because it's the end of a word. Mm-hmm. And one of our interpretations is that this word means sacrifice. Or actually in plural, sacrifices. So it's possible that it's been worn during some sort of ceremony where touching this word was vital. But we don't know, because we can't be 100% certain that it says sacrifices, because the vowel, this particular rune that has been so worn, if it's a different rune than the one we're proposing, then the word means something entirely different.
Right. Okay. Is it possible? Again, just this made me think. Just looking at the coin that I got out of my pocket, and that's what I just pulled up it on Google, that you could have like and you'll know more whether we even see this at all from any runic inscriptions, where you would have a collection of single runes or letters that would then mean something else, like a would make a word. Mm. So for example, on English coins, we have like Elizabeth II, DG, Reg, REG, which means Del Grecia Regina, which would mean like by the grace of God. Yeah. And then we have after that FD, Fidei Defensor, or Defender of the Faith. Is it possible that something like that could be represented, which again would make it even more impossible to translate, I guess?
It's an excellent question again. You have plenty of excellent questions. I like this.
Good. I have been doing this a while now, so I'm glad that I can ask the good questions.
It is very possible, if not plausible, or no, plausible is not the word, likely, I think, that we have abbreviations in the material of the Elder Futhari.
See, I make a good question and I let myself down by not knowing the word
abbreviation. I'm not the native speaker of English.
No, you're
using
correct.
This archaic word that only is used in spelling in the 1700s or something like that.
No, it's the correct word. I just couldn't find it at the time.
The people of the Germanic world who used runes in the Iron Age, they would have learned much about using writing culture from the cultures to the south, mainly the Romans. And the Romans, we know much about their writing. We have so many sources giving us plenty of abbreviations and epitaphs, and they have so many styles and different ways of putting writing together. And so I think what we need to see in the coming years is someone delving into researching what could possibly be our abbreviations. What could they mean? Because, you know, what most people will be thinking of is that each rune has also a name connected to it. And therefore, when we find one J rune, it always means year, because the J rune means Yara. It's the word for year, and so on. But that's not necessarily always the case, I think. And I think we should look more into this. That's a good question that we haven't fully answered. And I think is a very interesting question.
Yeah, I think it would be. It would be fascinating because if say we lost everything, you know, all computers, I guess, you know, all technology and all the pieces of paper, and you found a coin from today that had these little letters on, people surely be like,
what does this mean?
Yeah, what do they mean? Because obviously, again, with a Brexit or a coin, you have a finite area and you're going to get on what you can, but it would make sense that you would kind of shorthand where possible.
Yeah. There are plenty of bractites with very short inscriptions, just a few letters. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we have longer inscriptions on other materials as well, where there are clearly some sort of, well, if not abbreviation, then certainly some sequence of runes that doesn't make sense to us. So there's something going on that we haven't properly figured out yet.
Mm-hmm.
Might be abbreviations, might be something else, but definitely interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, I think we're coming to like an hour and a half-ish. I have one last, I guess like a comment. I don't know if you even would have a thought on it. Was it at all frustrating, I guess, when this was found and put out there that you, I'm trying to think of how to word it, because there are obviously a certain sect of people that are interested in this that are unfortunately nationalists, white nationalists, and like to use Odin in any possible way. And the Brexit does, not unfortunately, because it is a piece of, it is what it is at the time. It didn't mean what it meant, but there is just a swastika foremost there. Like it's there in every image that you see. And obviously, you know, this is predates its modern day meaning by, you know, well over 1,000 years, but you can't help but think, or I couldn't, as soon as I saw it, was like, oh fuck, you're going to get a certain group of people who are going to go, well, there's a swastika on this and it's got Odin on it. We're just going to use this in any way we can to try and push our agenda.
Yes. I have received some annoying mails here.
Oh, have you really? Because thankfully, I didn't actually see any comments when I was looking and kind of reading through. I didn't see any comments alluding to it, but it was certainly in my mind, and I assumed it would be out there.
There are, of course, drawing attention to the swastika is legitimate. It's interesting, and we don't really know what it means. There are tons of assumptions and theories and hypotheses of what it could mean. Truth is, there is no consensus about it. And of course, it's a symbol that crosses cultures and areas and time as well.
Yeah.
So we have no way of really knowing what it means everywhere at all times. But of course, it is a cultural symbol in the Germanic cultures, and it's used in Scandinavia for several centuries, which is of course the reason why the damn Nazis appropriated the symbol to start
exactly.
with. Potent cultural expression, and they've taken it away from us, actually destroyed it in ways. So
absolutely,
it's impossible for us to reappropriate it into. I mean, I'm not sure we should even, because you know.
Yeah, I spoke about that with Katie Beard last week, and that idea of how there are some symbols that we can kind of, because you see other symbols trying to be adopted. I feel like we can kind of stop going too far, but the swastika, I think, has just unfortunately gone way too far.
Yeah.
And you see different attempts to try and reclaim it over the years. And it's just like, it's not working. It's certainly not Certainly not this close to the event. Maybe in like 100, 200 years when the distance opens up and the people who were directly affected aren't still alive and around. I think then maybe there would be an opportunity to try and separate. But I think right now it's just not something that can happen.
Nah. No, it's not. And luckily, I haven't seen much about any kind of right-wing Nazi fascist use of this. I've seen some people discuss about it, and I haven't always been able to determine whether the people discussing it are discussing because they are right-winged or because they just generally have an interest. It's sometimes a bit difficult to determine. But I have had mails from right out Nazi people. And it's not cool.
That's so ridiculous. Just because there are probably some people who just think because you're working on it that you are in some way an ally of something. I don't know. I don't understand why they would even email you to say what, to be like, good find.
You would be amazed what scholars get into their email.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah. There are many mansplainers out there.
Oh, really? Oh, are they telling you what it means?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
It's very fascinating and also very notable that whenever I've been working with female colleagues, they get more than I do.
Oh, really? Okay.
And I think I've been, in this case, I've been working with a runologist, Lisbeth Imal, who has more than 20 years of experience. And this is I've been working with runes for this is the second article I'll be writing about runes. And she get most of the mansplaining.
Yeah. Wow.
It's really fascinating how the gender thing is. I'm the apprentice here.
Yeah,
I'm the one who should be getting all the.
Yeah. Wow, that is, it's fascinating and also disappointing.
It really is. Really annoys me quite a lot.
We get it with, we release episodes or clips from episodes, and you know you'll have someone like yourself on, or like Leisha Gadea, or Terry Gunnell. You know, real kind of high level scholars. There's not many people above them, if anyone, and they'll say something and people will be in the comments like, no, that's wrong. And it's like, oh, fuck off.
Very often we say things and then later on think of it, oh, why did I say that? Because I could somehow modify it slightly because this detail is relevant and so on. Because as scholars, there's always something that you could draw in to make the argument somehow smoother and so on. But of course, there's always going to be some idiot who think they knows better.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because they read it in a book by... This, again, to wrap it back up to... Just as we wrap up, kind of do full circle, to go back to runes, there are so many books by people who aren't runologists, and I see them recommended time and time and time again. And any group where somebody asks about how do I learn about runes, it's very rare that you ever see like somebody say, oh, Runes, a Handbook by Michael P. Barnes. Like, go for that one, read that one, because that's a book by a legit runologist. It's always like, I'm sure there's one by someone called Lisa Chamberlain, and it's like, is she a legit runologist? Don't think so. Like, and then, and I'm not just hating on her, but there are just a bunch of these books that are written by, and they always have like rune magic in the title.
Yes.
And they're just by, you know, the average Joe who has no understanding or no like scholarly or academic understanding of runes. They've just kind of gone with it. And then people get their information from it and then wonder why it's inaccurate.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, in a way, scholarship is like that. I mean, I started off with place names and language history, and then on to runology.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, within the frame of the world of universities, scholarly arguments, peer review, and so on. But I mean, yes, I don't want to discourage going full into runology research on your free time, of course. But mm-hmm. yeah, read the books made by scholars. Do that. Yeah,
absolutely. I would love to speak to you again about place names.
Yeah,
I feel like we could have a good conversation on that.
Certainly.
So, okay, let's wrap this up. Do you have a little bit of time to answer some questions?
I do, yes.
After, perfect. So for anybody listening, after every show, what we do is we have a Q&A with the guest, which is for Patreon only. You can access all the episodes after the fact on there as well and listen to them after. You can also ask your question ahead of time and ask them live in the show as well. Through the little live chat feature that you can watch through Patreon. And it starts from £3 a month, and there's a bunch of different levels where you can get different things, but it helps us keep the show going, pay for Ron to edit, Alyssa to do the social media, Bob to do all the pestering of the guests. Anybody who's been listening for the last 20, 30 episodes, we've got such good guests on, and that's down to Bob emailing and pestering people all the time to come and talk to us. So yeah, it helps us keep those people going. So if you can support, please just pop over to the, it's just patreon.com/NordicMythologyPodcast. And then if you can leave a 5-star rating, a positive review wherever you get your podcasts, that would be great. And then it's just Nordic Mythology Podcast and all the different social medias, YouTube. And Chris, do you have, are you mainly Twitter?
Yes, mainly Twitter.
Is it just under your name?
Yes. So first name and last name, that's where you'll find me on Twitter, Christoph Vashush.
Wonderful.
And
yeah,
I'm mostly writing about language and cultural history on Twitter. Occasionally there's something off topic to that, but yeah.
Yeah. But go and give Christoph a follow. And I remember, just, am I right in thinking you did work on the, do we speak about this before, the oldest runestone as well? And you posted a bunch of, I remember seeing a bunch of your tweets when that was released as well.
Yes. I think the museum got a bit surprised by their attention on social media that day.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, absolutely. I'm sure they did. Okay. Yeah. Let's wrap this up, and then we will have a little Q&A session.